It's a conspiracy. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The popularity of conspiracy theorist Alex Jones is surging in the U.S., but conspiracies aren't just an American thing.
What's really going on? Who's really benefiting? That is the mindset of the average Russian consumer of news.
Also today, this writer didn't want to go to Ukraine at first, but then he spoke to his godmother.
She tells me, your mama black, your daddy black, your city is black. So she admonished me to try something different.
And beer companies are capitalizing on Canada's new weed laws. Think cannabis-infused beer.
I think it's smart for beverage companies to think, okay, what are the products that future consumers may be interested in? And let's get a foothold in that industry.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. The Umbrella Man on the grassy knoll shot JFK with a poison dart. 9/11 was an inside job. Conspiracy theories. As long as people have been around, there have been stories, even outlandish ones, to explain everything. Over the past few days, Apple, Facebook, Spotify, and YouTube have been busy taking down content provided by right-wing talk show host Alex Jones. They accuse him of hate speech. He's also claimed 9/11 was an inside job and spread the story that the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012 was a hoax. Jones and his InfoWars show have been around for many years, but since the dawn of Trump, he's become more popular. In fact, after being removed from several platforms, the InfoWars app shot up to number 3 in the Apple News rankings today. This buy-in to conspiracy theories is far from an American phenomenon. In fact, it's long been far more prevalent in other countries. David Filipov knows this well. He was, until recently, the bureau chief in Moscow for the Washington Post. He's now editor of news at Northeastern University and joins me in our studios. Good to see you, David. So conspiracy theories in Russia, how popular are they?
Who put you up to that question?
I'm capable of asking a few on my own.
How do we know that? You know, in Russia, there has so long been so little trust in the government. Way back to the Soviet Union, everybody could see that what they're saying is not true. They're saying we're living well, we're living badly. Ergo, everything they tell you is a lie. What's really going on? Who's really benefiting? That is the mindset of the average Russian consumer of news. And so whenever any news is put out, the first thing people ask is, they're telling us that. What do you think the story really is? What must be going on? Whether they're trying to pull the wool over our eyes. And the authorities in the Putin years have learned to manipulate this. They're criticizing the government. That must mean they're against Russia. Let's find out who's funding them. Is it the Soros Foundation? Is it the U.S. government? Is it the Department of State? Must be somebody who's against us. And they play on that uncertainty. And, you know, the best example that you can read in English is RT, question more. Like, what are they telling us? Why are they telling it this way? Let's find out the real truth. And so they can throw out any malarkey with no basis and no reasoning, just to say, well, there's this version which they're telling you, but we don't trust them. What about this? What if this were true? And thus murk up any possible fact.
RT, of course, is the Kremlin-funded English-language television coming out of Russia. So wasn't there like any period right after the fall of the Soviet Union and what we are seeing today in Russia where there was kind of an opening up where people were willing to like believe the truth?
So, I mean, really, my primitive way of analyzing this is, what do people think of the media? At the end of the Soviet Union, when independent journalists had opened up so much of the truth and allowed it to get printed and had it printed that people knew. So journalism in a brief period, the late 80s, early 90s, had a good reputation because they were printing the things that people knew to be true. So for a while there, people would read reports and think that that's what's going on. And the journalists who did it were doing a good job. Independent journalism works against authoritarians. As authoritarians come in, they need to bend, break, twist, whatever, to make the media seem as untrustworthy as possible. And in Russia, what happened was various oligarchs took over independent media outlets to use them for their own gains and to improve their own situations, and therefore turned good journalists into what we used to call yellow journalism, right? Trust in the media decreased, the ability of the authorities to use the media increased. And that's what we got here. If you jump to the United States right now, when half of Americans believe that when you and me open our mouths, we're lying by definition, that creates this place where somebody like a President Trump can say, well, that's what the media is telling you. They're criticizing me, But how do you know they're telling the truth? And whose interests are they really serving? I'm serving your interests. So they must not be their enemies. Don't believe them. Believe whatever it is I say.
You often appeared on Russian TV to explain stuff from the United States. You speak fluent Russian. How would you kind of debunk what was clearly a conspiracy theory from, you know, the audience?
Everything NATO is trying to do indicates that they're planning the invasion of Russia, or at least neutering Russia and making Russia subservient, is not so much a conspiracy theory, but it's a worldview that basically presumes that NATO is about to attack one way or another. I mean, you'd go, well, there's no evidence whatsoever. I mean, you see some military presence there, but they're not offensive. They're defensive units, and there never was and never is any plan. Oh, you're just deluded. Look at all these ships. Look at all these military forces. Clearly, NATO is coming through. And you try to give what you understand to be the facts. But the problem is, since I don't have a conspiracy theory in response, a conspiracy theorist already has a sharp argument. There was no Newtown. It was a big scam, the deep state. And you are trying to prove a negative. No traction. You cannot prove to somebody who believes in a conspiracy that it wasn't a conspiracy.
So, David Filipov, what I'm really intrigued by is, do you see similar trends in the U.S. that Russia went through, like right after the fall of the Soviet Union, that has led to fake news or conspiracy theories and has allowed them to kind of take root here?
Okay, so let's say the theory that the CIA developed the AIDS virus as a biological weapon that got out of control and then it's spreading all over the world, and that's why we have AIDS in Russia. That's a theory that got popular. And you would still see people into the 90s who still have that belief, people who haven't had that wiped by a stream of facts that they find adequate. When they go back to that story, that's what they remember. It's sort of like birthers, residual birthers, who still insist that even after Trump recanted on that and blamed Hillary Clinton, still insist that Barack Obama was born not in the United States, right? You basically see these residual stories. Ukraine shot down that jet as a way of picking a fight with Russia. The Americans poisoned the spies in England as a way of picking a fight with Russia. As long as you have the ending of that, they're looking for ways to pick fights with Russia. Then those theories continue to feed it, regardless of whichever facts get in the way. So here in the United States, we see that in political campaigns where people just bring up stuff or repeat stuff that's patently untrue.
The Kremlin, we believe, is behind the spread of some conspiracy theories, but do they ever clamp down? Do they ever try to prevent the spread of conspiracy theories?
The conspiracy that they've had the most work on is the one about Russian collusion. But you see, they didn't have a problem because it was easy to persuade ordinary Russians that this whole thing is crazy. Who thinks that a few Russian hackers can actually take down American democracy? So their response to our conspiracy theory that there's a bunch of Russian spies going around destroying our democracy and posting things on Facebook, it was very easy to get Russians to go, that is ridiculous. How can 49 ads on Facebook swing the election of the oldest continuously peaceful transition of power democracy in the universe? And, you know, I agree with them, actually. I actually think that the effect of all that has been overstated. It wasn't difficult for the Kremlin to shoot down this conspiracy theory because it lined up with everything Russians want to believe, that American democracy is something that you can't just undo.
So given all that, finally, do you have any thoughts on what speech, if any, should be removed from online platforms?
I don't think you should remove any of it. I think people should learn how to consume information. And I believe that, you know, in the Baltics, they've been doing this, trying to teach people how to consume news so that you can, for yourself, separate real facts based on facts from somebody's opinion, which is based on nonsense. People have to decide they want to learn, and then they have to be taught and have to learn how to distinguish fake stuff from real stuff. You can't do what the Kremlin does. They've got 4,500 sites that have been banned. You can't do that. You can't stop people from getting information. You have to teach people to understand how to read information.
That's David Filipov, news editor at Northeastern University here in Boston and formerly with the Washington Post in Moscow. So what does it take for tech giants like Facebook, YouTube, Spotify to ban so-called problematic content, things like hate speech, misinformation, and fake news? We put that question to Shira Frankel. She's a tech reporter with the New York Times. The answer, she says, depends on which part of the world we're talking about.
For instance, Germany has kind of been at the forefront of regulating these companies and demanding that misinformation, false news, things that are potentially damaging to people be removed, and they be removed in a timely manner. And because Germany has created so many laws around this, they force tech companies to be incredibly accountable. On the other end of the spectrum, you have countries like actually the United States, in which free speech is, you know, part of our law, it's part of our local culture. And so these companies have not responded as quickly, and they've been kind of waffling a little bit about, well, what they're going to do about fake news and how they're going to respond to requests to take it down. And you've also seen them develop, in many cases, country-specific approaches. So Facebook announced last month that it was going to start a new policy in which countries like Myanmar and Sri Lanka, which have seen fake news, false news, lead to actual real-world violence, they were going to sort of set aside a special team to take down those posts. And they were saying that even though in other countries those posts wouldn't be removed, because in Sri Lanka and Myanmar real world violence had occurred, they were creating a new set of rules just there.
Yeah, what happened with the Myanmar case and Facebook? Because I remember when that came up last year and people were killed.
Exactly. And, you know, it was interesting at the time. I was one of the journalists that went to Myanmar and met people there and spoke to Facebook afterwards. Facebook kept saying, well, you know, what they're doing doesn't violate our rules because they're posting things that are untrue, but they're doing it under their real names. And they're not actually saying go out and kill Rohingya, which is, you know, the minority Muslim group in Myanmar that has been targeted in a lot of these violent attacks. And so because nobody was saying kill Rohingya, it didn't qualify as hate speech under Facebook's rules. What they were saying was things like, oh, you know, the Rohingya are raping and murdering our children, and the Rohingya have destroyed a Buddhist temple. They were spreading enough rumors about the Rohingya that it was leading to acts of violence. And so Facebook basically had to look at that situation and reevaluate its own rules.
So let's go to the case of Germany, which has these new laws that they're enforcing. What drives the kind of arrival of these new laws? Is it public outcry about what they see online?
So Germany is a really interesting case because Germany has such strict laws about hate speech. Lawyers and government regulators were able to use their existing laws and sort of codify those to crack down on tech companies like YouTube and, you know, Twitter and Facebook, and say to them, this is not going to fly with us. This content has to be removed, and it has to be done in a timely manner. You're going to have 24 hours or 36 hours to take this down from the moment that we complain about it to you. And all these companies had to really scramble their resources to respond to this. Facebook opened a massive center in Germany and hired people there just to respond to taking down content requests.
Wow.
And so we've seen, you know, this country, by using its existing laws, really sort of force a change, at least within their own borders.
What kind of precedent do you think this decision to take down Jones's content is going to set for how these tech giants operate here in the U.S.?
I mean, people watching this are going to start going after other right-wing conspiracy theorists and trying to get Facebook and YouTube and Twitter, for that matter, to enforce the same kind of rules against them. What we are waiting for right now is to find out if this is just a one-off. Was this just a case where there was so much public outcry and so much attention that they felt forced to act? Or is this actually going to be a new sort of – are we seeing a new moment for these companies where they really take action against content that until now they've allowed to pass because it has such a massive following online?
Have you heard concerns from civil libertarians about what taking down Jones's content does generally to freedom of speech?
There are certainly people out there, a great number of people out there, who are concerned that this is a slippery slope and that you start with Alex Jones and that next thing you know, Facebook is deciding what is and isn't allowed to be said online. And so we're definitely hearing people, especially those who are very protective of the First Amendment, say, hold on, we know that what he was saying was abhorrent to quite a few people, but we don't want to see this to be the beginning of our end to free speech online. And so I think they're watching this very, very carefully and trying to suss out what the next steps are by the tech companies and how to make sure that they don't overreach right now.
Shira Frankel with the New York Times speaking with us from San Francisco. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just ahead on the show, how being black in Ukraine made an American writer rethink racism at home. It's on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're coming up this weekend on the anniversary of the events in Charlottesville, Virginia, the violence of the Unite the Right rally and the killing of one of the counter-protesters. It was a glaring reminder, if any was needed, of how painful and explosive race continues to be in this country. Here on The World, our aim is the international perspective. So for our next story, we're turning to a man who has an unusual vantage point when it comes to race relations here in the U.S., Terrell Germain Starr is a reporter with The Root, and he's working on a memoir about his experience living in former Soviet states and looking back at his own country. He spent years going back and forth to Russia, Georgia, but especially Ukraine. It's a place he speaks of with a lot of affection, though he says it's not always a comfortable place for a black man. So I asked him what drew him to that part of the world in the first place.
In the summer of 2001, I applied for a volunteer program that slated me to go to one of number of like 15 countries around the world. On the application, it asks you, if we select you for this program, we'll pay for it. Where would you like to go? And it gave you a list of places, and I chose all the black ones, right? And then, you know, I get antsy, submit my application after a few months, and call the program, and the secretary picks up and says, hey, Terrell, I'm just getting ready to write your acceptance letter. You're going to Russia. I said, Russia. And so I felt a little bit discouraged and a little disappointed. Called my godmother. She said, you know, I'm hoping that she's going to give me some emotional support. And she, just with a very straight voice, she tells me, your mama black, your daddy black, your city is black, your college is black. And she went down the whole list of how black my life and existence was, right? So she admonished me basically to try something different. And I just said, okay. And I went. And, you know, honestly, I went to Russia. I had a really great experience. I loved it. And
so you were kind of hooked.
I was hooked. Listen, I had a wonderful time in Russia. I was enthralled. Mind you, this young, nervous 21-year-old from inner city Detroit, Philander Smith, just scared to death. I never imagined that that person who was nervous and apprehensive about going to Russia would be talking to you today about how much I'm trying to promote the beauty and the wonders of Ukraine and Georgia and even, you know, having really complex conversations about Russia, because that's a great place, too. I mean, everyone defines Russia by Putin. And that's certainly not the case. And so these are all beautiful countries with beautiful histories. And I think that people have allowed the political climate to paint a negative portrayal of Russia that's not true, and Russians that aren't true, as well as Ukraine, right? I mean, I have no problem talking about the racism I experienced there, but Ukraine is a great place. I have no problem talking about the racism I experienced here. And so I don't want to let anyone – I want to have conversations that kind of really promote how interconnected that we should be. And for me, that hub, ironically, is Ukraine.
Ironic in part because Terrell says he's experienced blatant racism there just walking down the street.
Being a black person there – you do deal with a lot, because I think that as black people, we can't escape racism. White supremacy is a global issue. And so within the Ukrainian context, what I find very ironic, however, is that the authorities there are definitely looking to Washington as a protector against Kremlin aggression or Kremlin expansionism. And my conversations with Ukrainians there, they all look to America as that moral force. And I find it ironic that in my conversations with them, that there are a couple things that they tend to overlook. One, the racism that exists in this country and the racism that exists even in Ukraine. And so most of my friends there are of black and Ukrainian descent, meaning that their mothers are Ukrainian on the most part and their fathers are from one of many countries on the continent of Africa. Mm-hmm. And my friends are constantly talking about the racism that they face there and the contradictions of its government saying that they want to be a Western society, a fully developed European nation, yet it refuses to deal with the rising trends of xenophobia and racism. And one of those experiences for me personally took place in this Western Ukrainian city of Yaremche. It's a resort town in the Carpathian Mountains. My first day, I was walking down the main street and some guy drove by very quickly. He threw up the Heil Hitler salute at me and he spit at me.
Wow.
And he was far enough to where it didn't hit me, but He spit directly in my direction and he yelled something at me. And I didn't quite understand it.
Generally, though, how widespread is that kind of behavior that you encountered across Ukraine, and how evident are those skinheads?
I want to stress out the fact that I don't believe that Ukraine is a fascist, racist state. That's not what I'm saying. Now, going to directly answer your question, you know, I do feel like there is a growing trend of nationalist sentiment, of fascist sentiment there. It's a problem. And if you just look for gentlemen who wear the far right Nazi tattoos, like, they're everywhere. And they may not say anything, but you can see their signatures, which are their tattoos. You'll also see some of the gentlemen wearing 100, which means 100% white.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But it just shows you how complex Ukraine is, because it is a country that suffered under Stalin's expansionism. It was starved during the famine, but it was also one of the countries that that suffered a huge number of losses during World War II. But they also have a history of participating in the slaughtering of Jews. So, like, all these things are true. I think that my responsibility as a black person who writes about race for The Root here in the United States, as well as who travels to Ukraine often, and the purpose of my book is to talk about how complex racism and white supremacy is, and how various groups of people, whether they be Ukrainian or Polish or, you know, or American white people, participate in the white supremacist colonial system. And that requires nuance, and it really pushes us to push back against this narrative, this simplistic narrative of, oh, Ukraine is a fascist state and Ukraine, you know, like, it's just so widespread that it's just, you know, out of control, and it's actually not true. And that is that's a very difficult conversation, but it's one that I hope that in book length I'll be able to have and people will be able to engage.
Terrell Germaine Starr is a senior reporter at The Root. He's been speaking with us from New York. Great to meet you, and thanks so much for your thoughts, Terrell.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Let's take a minute now to preview a story on tomorrow's show.
Double, 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 toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble.
Nekeak eta kezkak borratzenekin, suak errebeza bertzak irakin.
This is Shakespeare translated into Basque, a language unlike any other in Europe. By rights, the Basque language should be dead, and for decades, speaking Basque in Spain was actually forbidden. How Basque has survived in Spain, in France, and among U.S. immigrants, that story on the show tomorrow.
Support for this podcast comes from LegalZoom. Most Americans don't have a will. 20 years ago, that wasn't a shocking statement. You had to find a trustworthy attorney and pay them by the hour to draft your will. But these days, there's no excuse. LegalZoom has made it easy to create your own will, and they're not a law firm, so you don't pay hourly rates. August is National Make a Will Month at LegalZoom.com. So now it's your turn to take control of your family and assets with an estate plan. It starts with a will or a living trust. And if you don't know which one is right for you, no problem. LegalZoom's network of independent attorneys can advise you on what's best for you and your family. That's why more than 1 million people have used LegalZoom for their estate planning needs. Just go to LegalZoom.com/world to check out LegalZoom's Last Will and Living Trust Estate Plans and get special savings. That's LegalZoom.com/world to take care of your family and save money doing it. LegalZoom.com/world.
I'm Marco Werman. Just ahead on The World, Karolina Chorvath was born in Belgium to an American mom and a Slovak dad. Her family moved between countries and cultures, which made her ask, where was home?
When I moved to the United States, I think people expected me to know more and to be more prepared with American culture. And I just was not.
Third Culture Kids on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Every day you hear us cover the news from all over the globe on the show. And for many of us, this job is kind of an extension of who we are. We come from all over and often have multiple ties or personal connections to far-flung places and languages. One example, Sarah Birnbaum, one of our producers here on the show, recently attended a bat mitzvah.
It was my niece's bat mitzvah. Her name is Leia. And if you've ever been to one of these things, you know, it follows a typical pattern. There's a service in the morning at synagogue. And then sometime afterwards, there's a huge dance party. And, you know, there's the typical hora. And there's plenty of Taylor Swift. And the traditional father-daughter dance. But the thing at this bat mitzvah was there was the slightly less traditional Japanese Olympic dance.
I mean, there's never really been a girl like me.
This is Leia, and the reason there was that Japanese Olympic dance is because her bat mitzvah happened to be in Tokyo, Japan, because that's where Leia's from. Well, it's sort of where she's from.
What I consider a girl like me is a girl that's, like, been introduced to many different cultures and communities. So I'm half Chinese and half American. So I've been introduced to Chinese cultures and American cultures. And I live in Japan, so Japanese cultures. And I'm Jewish, so Jewish cultures.
Her mom is from Dalian in Shanghai in China. And her dad is Jewish from Atlanta. But Leia was born in Japan and grew up in Japan. So, like, where would you say she's from?
Yeah, my culture is totally different than my parents. Even if I do explain to them, they won't really understand. They're never going to live through what I'm living through. They're never going to know what it's like to go to my school, seeing the different languages that are spoken at the tables. I'm a foreigner everywhere I go. When I go to China, people are like, oh, Waiguoren, which means foreigner. You look American. You look European. When I go to America, they're like, oh, you look Asian. And I'm like, no, I don't.
There are kids like this all over the world, kids caught between places and languages. Like Leia, some are the children of mixed marriages. Some are refugees or the children of immigrants. They're sometimes called third culture kids, TCKs. I'm half a TCK on my mom's side, but in our newsroom, we have a full-on third culture kid.
Hi, Marco. I guess I'm not much of a kid anymore.
No, I don't think you are. Carolina Horvath, and you spell that C-H-O-R-V-A-T-H, and I'm inclined to pronounce that Horvath, but is that right?
It's right and it's wrong at the same time. Depending on where I am and who I'm speaking to, I will change my name to kind of fit the situation.
Yeah, so give us an idea of the different circumstances where you do that.
So, for example, I was born Carolina Horvath, and in the United States, when I first moved here, people called me Carolina Chorvath, and now I've kind of developed it and made it my own and said that I'm Carolina Chorvath.
Carolina was born in Belgium and then spent the first years of her life in the Netherlands. Her father grew up in what was then Czechoslovakia. His first language is Slovak. And her mother is American.
When my family would have friends over, we would have different countries and languages in the room. So I was exposed to Spanish, German, Czech, Slovak, English, Dutch, and I would bounce between each language. At the age of three, I guess I knew who spoke what language, and I would switch between each person.
Carolina moved to the U.S. at the age of four.
I lived in Midland, Michigan with my family. I think now the town has become a little bit more international, but at the time, it was like me and maybe an Indian girl in the class and a Belgian girl, and we were all just lumped into like the odd foreigners. I think part of what was hard too was because I'm white and because I'm European, people, and because I speak English the way that I do. My mother teaches English as a second language, and it was one of my first languages. When I moved to the United States, I think people expected me to know more and to be more prepared with American culture. And I just was not.
We felt that was what was best for you. But then you had to try and assimilate to culture in the U.S., which was completely new to you.
Carolina, is that your mom?
Yes, it is. And I asked her about those early years.
I remember bringing you to preschool and we had to pack a lunch. And you didn't like peanut butter and jelly. And you didn't like sandwiches like other kids did. So we asked, okay, well, what do you want? And you said you wanted pate on toast. That's what we sent you with. And other kids thought that was weird. And the teacher thought that was odd. That was always something. You didn't quite fit in over there, didn't quite fit in over here. And I think it was something that you were always aware of on some level. And I was too.
And Marco, my mom even struggled with what to call me, what my name was.
I know that sounds ridiculous. Here I'm your mother, and I don't know how to refer to you when I speak to others because you're Carolina Carolina, and now you're Carolina. So yeah. It depends on where we are and who I'm speaking to. And I think I have to think about, okay, who am I speaking with right now? Which name do I use for my child?
Yeah, I get all that. I mean, I still struggle to pronounce my mom's name. It's got two silent J's in it. Anyway, Carolina, where does the term third culture kid come from?
So it was originally coined in the 1950s, initially to describe these children of Americans working and living abroad. Over the years, though, it's taken on a much broader meaning.
And when did you first come across it?
I first came across it when my family was actually moving back to Europe after being in the United States for several years. I was moving to Poland to go to an international high school, and all of the parents were given this book kind of to help them describe what their kid might end up being, which was a third culture kid. So my mom told me about this term, and I finally realized where I belonged. I was so excited to go to this school because there were going to be a bunch of people just like me.
And what was this book?
It's called Third Culture Kids Growing Up Among Worlds, and it's a bit of a TCK Bible. And after all these years, I wanted to talk to one of the authors, Ruth Van Recken. I asked her about the term and what it means to her.
We define it as someone who's living for a significant part of their developmental years, their first 18 years, outside of their parents' passport countries or country. It can be the families who come from Mexico and move to California for 6 months of year, right? And go back.
Or maybe don't go back. I mean, the idea is that a third culture kid is living a displaced life with no real sense of home, right?
Absolutely. It's kids growing up outside of their parents' culture, and they create their own culture, the third culture.
So it's not about why the parents have arrived in a third country or culture. It's about the confusion and homelessness felt by the child, yeah?
Yes, it can be anyone. The way that the term is right now, it really is more so based on the experience and the psychological impact on the child.
Yeah, so I can see how a book like that might have been really helpful for you to kind of come around to the realization that this was a recognized phenomenon, this was a thing, and that there were reasons why you felt kind of unmoored.
Absolutely, especially when I came back to the United States for college. You know, it's a time when you're needing to introduce yourself and kind of explain quickly who you are. And it was something that I kind of clung to for a bit, that term, third culture kid. And I ended up meeting other people at college who were just like me, and they totally understood.
Like, our friendship is a prime example. You know, I met you during orientation. We really bonded over the fact that we had moved so many times.
That's my friend from college, Natasha. She's also a TCK, and she just gets it. I don't have to explain myself like I do with other people.
It's such an easy thing to bond over because kind of, you know, you share the same experiences and the same questions, like, where are you from? It's like, oh, great, I have to answer this question again. People ask you, like, oh, so you've moved around so many times, where's home? And it's like, oh, I really don't know.
Technically, Natasha's Malaysian. She was born there, her passport is from there.
But I don't necessarily see myself as someone who, you know, is proud to be Malaysian or really associates herself in any way really related to the country. So I feel kind of a fake when I say, oh, I'm Malaysian or I'm from Malaysia. Yeah. But then you don't want to say, oh, well, I was born here, but then I moved here, and I feel like I'm kind of culturally confused. It just, I think, gives such a wrong impression because, I think one of the toughest things when you're outside of the international kind of third culture community is explaining the lifestyle that you've had. And, you know, you're thinking, how do we share certain things about our life abroad without coming across as a total snob.
Yeah.
So my answer always is tailored to the person I'm talking to. If they seem seemingly interested in what I have to say, then maybe I'll go a little bit more in depth. But if not, I'll just say, you know, born in Malaysia, but currently here.
Carolina, I'm curious. Had Natasha read Third Culture Kids growing up among worlds?
You know, I don't think she did. I don't think she did.
She just got it. So if people are interested, I mean, what does she say? What do you say you are?
I definitely still switch around, but Natasha absolutely has an answer for that.
My entire identity is made up of my experiences, you know, experiencing different cultures and being in different places and speaking to different people. And, you know, I really believe that Third Culture Kids are beyond racial, are beyond national and social boundaries.
Is that a fairly common view among TCKs that you know, Carolina? Do you feel that way?
You know, I'm honestly not sure. I'm obviously only can speak from my own experience as a white person, too. I hadn't heard this until Natasha brought it up. I found it to be absolutely fascinating. And when I looked at the conversations that I've had with my groups of friends that are Third Culture Kids, I was really, it was a bit eye-opening to realize that, you know, we had our relationships not because of our passport or, you know, what religion we were. It was really just based on our experiences, our interests.
And yet there are so many people these days who are kind of embracing an identity in race or a nation or their religion. So I wonder if you think that with others who are identifying less as being of a nation or a race or religion, whether you think that's a good thing.
I don't want to say that one is better or worse than the other, but I do think that there's a benefit to being able to identify with other people on a human level, on the things that are beyond surface level. I think that, you know, there's a good sense of empathy there, and I do think that's positive.
So one last thing, Carolina, now that you're kind of more at ease with the idea of who you are, with the idea of being unmoored at times and being moored at other times, has it changed what you think your native language is?
Not necessarily. It's changed how I think about my native languages. Honestly, finding the term third culture kid and being able to just dive into kind of what that means and what that means to me has been freeing. I don't feel like I need to choose just one country, one language.
So what are your native languages? What would you consider your native languages to be?
English and Slovak.
Carolina Horvath is the world's digital editor and producer. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco.
And if you're wondering about Leia, the teenager we heard from before, who is part American, part Chinese, and living in Japan, well, she is embracing her Jewish identity. At least that's what her aunt and our colleague Sarah Birnbaum found when she attended Leia's bat mitzvah in Tokyo.
So getting bat mitzvahed in some ways is the ultimate litmus test of identity because it marks your entry from childhood into adulthood. And so what it's done for Leia is it's inspired her to think more about her roots and to even kind of test things out. Like this summer, she told me she wanted to start keeping kosher.
Because I realized that I live in Japan. I love eating shrimp, love eating pork because I'm Chinese. But now I don't feel like I was Jewish before. I studied Judaism, yeah, but I didn't feel like I was a Jew. I actually, at one point, especially last year, I was ashamed to be a Jew. I didn't tell anyone that I was Jewish. I didn't feel like being Jewish was a good thing.
I don't know. I would think that in a place where your dad is different and your mom is different and your family is different, it feels like one more big difference.
Yeah. Sometimes I like being different. I like knowing different languages. I like feeling different, but not too different, if you know what I'm saying.
We have many more stories about global differences and similarities in our podcast about languages. The World in Words, listen wherever you get your podcasts or at pri.org/language. I'll never, ever, ever getting back. You're listening to The World. Seems like everyone wants a piece of the legal marijuana industry these days, even beer brewers. And the timing couldn't be better. 9 U.S. states plus D.C. have legalized recreational marijuana, and in Canada, the whole nation is set to legalize it on October 17th. Molson Coors is just the latest and one of the largest companies to announce it's creating a line of cannabis-infused beverages to be sold in Canada. Terry Lake is the VP of Corporate Responsibility for Hydropothecary. It's a Canadian cannabis grower that's partnering with Molson Coors to develop the drink. Terry joins us from Gatineau, Quebec. So what exactly is cannabis beer, Terry? How much marijuana content, how much alcohol content is in it?
Well, it's a really important question because a lot of people have confusion around this, Marco. There will be no alcohol in these cannabis-infused beverages. This will be a whole range of different beverages, and cannabis will be the active ingredient.
So for the product you're developing, after a couple of cans of this stuff, you won't feel tipsy, but you will feel stoned? I know that's the thing everybody wants me to ask.
Well, it goes back to our old sort of understanding or perhaps misunderstanding of cannabis generally. There are different active ingredients in cannabis. THC is the one that most people associate with that feeling of getting high, and it certainly is the one that has the greatest psychoactive effects. But there's also other cannabinoids, active ingredients, including CBD or cannabidiol, and that is an ingredient that, while it may make you feel a little uplifted, its real effects are on reducing inflammation and reducing pain and modulating mood. So that really doesn't get you high in the sense that we're used to when we think of cannabis. So these beverages could actually be for different purposes. There may be one that puts you in a good mood to listen to some music or others that are more of a wellness drink.
What are these drinks going to taste like?
Again, a whole variety of different possibilities there. You could take a de-alcoholized beer, for instance, and have cannabis infused into that beverage. So people would get the taste of beer and yet get the effects of cannabis, whether that's THC or CBD. We see in the United States, for instance, you've got drinks like Happy Apple in Washington State that are an apple-flavored cannabis-infused drink. It could be soda water. It could be coffee flavors. Really, it's limitless. And this joint venture company that we're putting together with Molson Coors Canada will have really free rein to explore all those possibilities.
How do you exactly make a cannabis-infused beverage? Is it similar to making beer?
Well, it's actually not as easy as it sounds because, you know, alcohol is water soluble. So putting alcohol in a drink is relatively easy. But cannabis and the ingredients of cannabis are largely fat soluble, which means you need to have techniques in order to allow that active ingredient to stay in solution or at least suspended evenly in a drink. And there are proprietary technologies that are designed to do that. That's something that we hope to bring to the table in this joint venture so that you will have a drink that really will assume the taste and the look of the other components of the beverage.
So October 17th is the date for Canada to legalize marijuana. When will Canadians expect to see a Molson Coors cannabis beverage on store shelves?
Well, the Cannabis Act, which is the legislation passed by the Parliament of Canada, says that within a year, edibles and concentrates need to be brought into the regulation. And so we are hopeful that in September of 2019, we will see cannabis-infused beverages. And our goal will be to have those products available on the first day that they can be sold.
And Terry, say like 5 years from now, do you think it's going to be pretty typical for, you know, Canadians on their way home from work on a Friday afternoon to stop by a store and pick up a six-pack of cannabis beer?
I don't think it will be unusual. I don't think that cannabis-infused beverages will replace beer. I know that a great IPA is still my drink of choice, but it will certainly, for some people, be a substitute, something that they have as well as drinking alcoholic beverages. It's just another choice. And the stigma around cannabis here in Canada is dropping rapidly, and I think it's going to be widely accepted.
Terry Lake of Hydropothecary, the Canadian cannabis grower that's partnering with Molson Coors to develop a line of cannabis-infused drinks. Thanks very much, Terry.
Thanks, Marco. Great to talk to you.
Yeah, replace beer in Canada? Not likely. Especially now that Ontario's new premier, Doug Ford, has dropped the minimum price of beer, following through on a campaign promise.
Ontario, the day you've been waiting for is finally here. We're bringing back a buck of beer to Ontario.
Canada was the first country to require a minimum price for alcoholic beverages. The hope was that it would reduce alcohol-related deaths there. Until yesterday, that included a minimum price for a beer, which was $1.25 Canadian. But now, thanks to Ford, it's $1 a beer.
I don't judge anybody for the beer they drink, and I certainly don't judge anybody for wanting to get a cold beer for as little as out of their pocket as possible.
That's Josh McJanet, one of the founders of Dominion City Brewing, a craft brewer in Ottawa. He says people may appreciate paying just a dollar for a beer, but that's too low for microbrewers like him. This new lower minimum price for beer hurts small businesses, he says.
When you choose to buy our beer, you're buying it from a company that pays a living wage. It offers paid benefits to our employees. We buy in excess of $100,000 worth of locally grown agriculture that we actually make our beer from. This, of course, is completely different if you're trying to squeeze every possible cent of profit out of a beer, especially if you have to sell that for no more than a dollar.
So McJanet is fighting back. Dominion City is selling a special beer for more than a dollar, but for every beer they sell, they're donating a dollar to a charity that helps refugees in Ottawa. By the way, Doug Ford, Ontario's premier, has been accused of promoting anti-immigrant policies.
What our response is really about is to take it as an opportunity to have a discussion about what is the value of a good beer, not just a cold beer, and what is the value of a local business that's trying to build community as well as, you know, earn profit. And that's a big one for us. So I think we spotted an opening, just like maybe the premier spotted an opening. And I think we both maybe are taking this opportunity to have the conversation we want to have. We think a warm welcome goes well with a cold beer. So supporting refugees in our town is sort of a natural fit for us.
The Dominion City Brewing's beer will be a blonde ale called Buck a Beer for refugees in Ottawa. I got to say, all this talk of dollar beer, of pot beer, it's got me feeling happy. So that's how we're going to leave you today. This track is called Feeling Happy and was recorded in Guadeloupe in the 1960s. It's off a new CD of old dance tunes from Guadeloupe and Martinique, the two French departments in the Caribbean, all from the little-known but prolific Guadeloupe record label Disque Debs International, founded in the 1950s by the late Henri Debs. If the sounds here put you in a small Guadeloupian bistro under the palm trees with a cold one, then our work here today is complete. If you're simply enjoying these nostalgic grooves, that is totally okay, too. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.